Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we'll react to the FA Cup final at Wembley as Liverpool win their second trophy of the season. We'll talk about their monster mentality, their great new signing Luis Diaz, but we'll also reflect on Romelu Lukaku's performance and ask if he wasted his chance. We'll talk about the Women's FA Cup final as well as relentless Chelsea march on. Events in the Premier League too as Manchester City come from behind to get a point at West Ham United. But should Kevin De Bruyne have taken that vital penalty? We'll talk about the relegation battle in full. This is The Game. Hello there, it's Hugh Wizencroft. This is The Game podcast. Of course it is. I'm alongside Alison Rudd and Tony Cascarino. The former Celtic and Chelsea striker is here. Millwall legend, of course. So much for us to discuss. It was the FA Cup final this weekend, so let's start at Wembley. In fact, a couple of great finals at Wembley to begin with. Liverpool, no goals in this game between Liverpool and Chelsea. Once again, just like the League Cup final, went to penalties, and once again, it was Liverpool who got the job done. So there's not going to be any criticism for Liverpool during this podcast because we've got Alison Rudd, we've got Tony Cascarino. They love Liverpool with all their heart, so I'm going to have to provide the realism here, okay? Because everyone talks about the best team in the world, Liverpool under Jurgen Klopp. That is two cup finals where they haven't even scored a goal, okay? One of them, a goalkeeper, missed the decisive penalty. This one, they actually had a penalty to win it and they missed it. And no one ever criticises Liverpool. You can't criticise Liverpool. And at the end of the game, everyone's like, oh, there you go. I couldn't believe it. I was like, well, yeah, they are a brilliant team. And yeah, they might be the best team in the world. But, my word, hit the back of the net. If you want to be the best team in the world, score a goal, please. Anyway, I'm only jesting.
Sorry, Pep.
I'm only joking with you. It was a fantastic FA Cup final. The only thing it missed was goals, like I say. But actually, I said this to a mate yesterday. It might have been a worse game had someone scored. Because, of course, that changes the approach. Both teams needed a goal and were going for a goal for so long. But obviously, if one went 1-0 up, they might have shot up shop. It might have been a really defensive end to the game. It might have been really scrappy and loads of fouls and stuff like that. It had the brilliance of two teams going end to end, trying to score a goal, just like football's meant to be played. So I'm happy it was 0-0. The only thing I'm unhappy about is the fact that Chelsea didn't win. I mean, and Tony, you must be torn. You know, ex-Chelsea, yeah. Liverpool fan. How did you find that final?
Well, it was a re-edition of the League Cup final. For me, it was exactly the same scenario developed all over the pitch. The amount of chances that were created, I mean, the finishing in them two games was woeful. It was extraordinary. I mean, look, strikers and midfielders, whoever, you'll get judged on how clinical you can be to make the difference. The chances between the two games, I don't know. I haven't sat there and watched the whole two games back and counted. But in the two games, obviously the FA Cup, League Cup final, I bet there was probably 15 to 20 really great opportunities for both teams. I mean, because they both equally had the same type of scenarios. Mm. I mean, whether it's Robertson hitting the post from 2 yards out, whether it's
Pulisic,
Alonso had a couple. I mean, the chances were just there to be seen. And you think with so much money and so many talented players on view that no one could make the breakthrough, which was extraordinary.
I think that is partly down to deep respect that both sets of players had for the opposition goalkeeper. There were, but seriously, there were moments when you felt, oh, you know, that he's trying to be inch perfect there, rather than just going for it. Yeah. There's that extra split second of, have you ever done that, Tony, where you've thought, oh, I know this keeper's brilliant, I'm going to have to be inch perfect, which means that you're not inch perfect because it just sails slightly wide because overthought it.
I remember facing Neville Southall and having a little bit too much time and thinking, he was on top of me very quickly and thinking Neville, you know, that goalkeeper of huge stature and physical. I mean, you know, he's a bit of a crazy guy anyway, but he faced you head on. Mm. And that was quite intimidating because you do have that. Yeah, definitely. Peter Shilton as well. I played for Villa against Peter Shilton. I remember thinking he was 40 at the time. Mm. But he had a huge stature as a keeper. And like you say, you sort of knew if you had to beat him, you've really got to beat him. He's not going to give you anything. You know, that difference that you're talking about.
I think that does account for a lot of those, it's 2 inches the wrong side of the post shots that we had in both of those finals, to be honest. It's that you have to be, I don't know, you just must feel precise. You have to be absolutely really, perfect.
Yeah, precise is, yeah, perfect, precise, whatever word. Yeah, I think you have an element of that. But that's no different if you get on a one-on-one when you know you're with a centre-half who's lightning quick. You know, I remember playing against Paul Parker against QPR and I remember thinking the ball's down the channel and I was just waiting for him to go past me. And he did in a split second, you know. And likewise, I played against Henri. And I remember thinking, I've ended up in a one-on-one. I was about 36 at the time. And he's played down the channel. And I was just thinking, go down injured. You know, I remember thinking, just go down because I knew Henri was around me.
Yeah.
Jamie Carragher probably had the same thought when he faced Henri and he got, you know, at Highbury and had that experience.
Yeah.
But the other element of the... I agree with you, Tony. It was a bit Groundhog Day, wasn't it? It was very Groundhog Day, actually, watching the two games. Was that they had... I mean, Chelsea started sluggishly, nervously, defensively. But even so, I knew they would have... Within 20 minutes, they'd have a spell where they were dominant. Mm. It's exactly what happened in the previous final. Yeah. It went in patches, roughly 15-minute patches. Not scientifically, but roughly 50-minute patches where you felt, oh, they've clicked, they're going for it, don't they look smooth and wonderful? It's not going to last. Sure enough, flipped, and the other side get that 50-minute. I don't know why it's so metronomic in a final, as opposed, in the league game, it's a bit like
four draws. I mean, they've played each other four times this season and drew every game.
But it's not boredom. They're not sort of just coming up against the same things and unable to change it. It just seems to be... The way those two teams are formulated, set up, run, they can have the edge, but only for so long.
I do definitely think that sort of the modern sports science, the idea of the fitness levels now where they are, it is becoming as difficult to have the ball if you play as well as Liverpool and Chelsea do when they're on it, and the level of intensity that you have with it just to keep that going. I mean, imagine what it's like to... spend 15 minutes trying to get through Liverpool's press just because you've got we like to think that if you have the ball, then you're the one having an easy time of it. But it must be difficult to keep the ball and be on it for that long period of time against Liverpool, for example, because they're all over you. So I do definitely think sometimes it is just a bit of a lull where you give it away and you're like, right, do you know what? They've got it for a bit. Let's just try and be compact and stay behind the ball.
So
and...
do you think it's subconsciously or consciously what happens that happens then?
I do, but I mean, part of it is they're obviously very quality opposition as well. And once they do, so I think it does click and you hit a groove, you spend 2 minutes on the ball and then it's like, right, okay.
But you're implying that they accept lack of possession.
Yeah, they do. I think they do. I think they do. I mean, I'm not saying that they enjoy it, but I think they do because it's so hard to play at that level for so long. And I also think there's a part of it that thinks that it's a bit of jousting where you do genuinely feel like, right, we've spent 15 minutes here. We haven't got through them. Yeah, and you're like, right, let's try something else. Give them the ball. See if maybe we win it back and we can counter and there's a little bit more space for us in behind if Liverpool push on to us. And I do definitely think, you know, you're trying something. It's not working for 15 minutes. What do you do? Well, let's try it. If they've got it, maybe we'll nick it and we'll be, you know, I think it is part of it.
Well, if you take the first 15 minutes, which Alisson has alluded to, and likewise yourself, Hugh, is that the two wing-backs for Chelsea, Reece James and Alonso, didn't really venture past the halfway line. But as the first half wore on, it became, well, we're going to have to. You know, they're going to have to take a few more risks because Liverpool are quite obvious the way they play. They don't really change anything for anybody. Where Chelsea are going to be a little bit more unpredictable, like their forwards. You're never quite sure of the lineup with Chelsea. So with that, you know that Tuchel's playing a more of a chess game. So he's accepting that Liverpool are going to play this way, but we're going to have to change slightly as the game wears on, which they did. And then they started causing Liverpool problems.
I thought it was a great FA Cup final, I've got to say. The fact that my dog wanted to go for a walk during the second period of extra time made it a little bit difficult for me.
Oh, well, extra time wasn't great. Yeah, I thought that was a bit of a waste of space.
But I had to pause it, go out for a dog walk for 40 minutes.
You watched fake football then?
Well, I turned off you know, all the mobile data and Wi-Fi, and so I didn't know what had happened, and I was at home alone with the dog, so there was no one ringing me saying, oh my word, did you see that? I watched it, you know, in complete innocence, which at least which was at least, you know, something. I know, but yeah, you're right. It was fake football. The good news is I don't live in Wembley anymore because obviously I couldn't have done that when I was younger. But yeah, look, going back to the match, man of the match performance from Luis Diaz. I thought this was going to be one of the crucial areas, whether Reece James was right of a back three or the right wing back. And I actually thought Azpilicueta would have been the other player, but actually Trevor Chalobah started the game. Yeah. And Luis Diaz tore into him, particularly in the first half. Could have been a lot more. I know, The smug look on Alisson Rudd's face just then, when you realise that Liverpool have unearthed another superstar who's going to be at the club for the next 10 years. Ah, it was painful for me. That's all I've got to say. He was great. The only thing that he didn't do was score a goal. But that constant threat, I mean, he's got a way to go in his career. He can improve. He will get better, but already looks like such a talent for this team.
No, it's unbelievable, really. He has slotted in so well. He was one of the players that was trying to lift the crowd. I mean, I'm surprised they needed lifting. But, you know, he was doing that urging that they do to try and get the crowd going. I think he was into it more than any other player. Like, he couldn't believe his luck in some respects, but he wasn't overawed by it. To have that combination of to appear proud and humble to have been signed by Liverpool, a team he says he's always loved, and to form an instant rapport with the fan base, to be able to, because you have to be sort of cocky when you're a forward and a little bit selfish sometimes, to be able to do that in a team that some people are saying could be the greatest ever team, especially if they win the quadruple, they would be the greatest ever team. To do that and still maintain your own personality, belief in your in what you've got, just testament to how that group are not scared of attracting new people in, and the welcome he must have had. And I would love to know exactly all the things that were said to him, you know, ahead of his first few games, because he clearly, from the way he plays, believes you can form an instant rapport with the players on the pitch. You don't need time to work out who's running where, what type of pass you should play. It just gelled immediately, and he just seems so happy. It's astonishing. I think you could probably, I'm struggling to think of another player who's come from abroad who wasn't a great of the game, from a league that nobody really claims to be, you know, that great, and has adapted to the Premier League and his new club so quickly. And yes, you're right, Hugh, he didn't score. But in a sense, that didn't matter because he was, I think he would have, he scared. He scared Chelsea.
Bruno Fernandes wasn't bad when he came from Portugal.
Yeah, but what tangible evidence do you have of that?
He won about four Player of the Month awards
in
the first year.
No, but in terms of how's that club hasn't grown?
They haven't. They haven't, but there's a good argument to say Liverpool haven't grown. I mean, they probably would have been in this position without Luis Diaz.
They're growing, though.
They are.
They're going in the right trajectory.
I'm just going to argue because I can't stand the look of his smug face, Alison.
No, I agree.
Everything you say, I am arguing with everything that you say for this whole podcast.
Okay, can I just say one little thing on, you know, Diaz's performance?
Yeah.
Do you know what went under the radar, and I can't believe that his performance has not been talked about, was Trent's. I thought he was scarily good. His passing was just extraordinary. And you know what? For as much, and I'm guilty of this as well, as much stick as he's had for his defensive qualities, the two balls that come across the face of the goal, where he's got just beyond the post and he's just cleared for a corner. And I thought he handled Pulisic really well. and Alonso, they're a threat, you know. And a lot of times Trent gets left on his own because Liverpool are an offensive team that sometimes he gets just caught and Henderson can fill in for him. I thought Trent's passing, I mean, the ball he gave to Diaz for the golden opportunity, the outside of his boot was, well, I mean, apart from De Bruyne, really, who can do that sort of pass? I thought Trent was amazing. And I had to do a composite before the game for the Times. And I put Reece, and I said the two best right backs in the world. Reece for me, or wing backs, right, or right backs. I said, I just tad give a head to Reece. And I come around and think,
what did you do that for?
Because I really was a coin flip. Honestly, Al, it was a coin flip between them.
Do you regret it now, though?
Well, no, but after his game, I thought, and I kept thinking of defensive qualities for Trent as well. And that game was one of the best defensive performances I've seen from Trent. And that was one of the reasons why it was 0-0.
Gareth Southgate looked deeply uncomfortable to me watching that game. And I think it was partly because he doesn't know how he's going to fit Trent into his team. Mm.
No, I agree with that. I wouldn't be surprised.
He turns up in midfield all the time.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if Trent didn't make the squad, to be perfectly honest. I know that sounds insane.
No, that would mean, to me, that there's just something is wrong with that. There's been many greats in international football, especially in England, who haven't made squads. Mm. But that would be up their highest order. That would be like, really? I'd even want to take him as a centre forward.
Is he going to start for England?
Look, who are you playing against is important. If you're playing against a team that you'd really fear...
I mean, in England's best team, does he start?
Well, he's really close. I'd have to look how he was at the time. I'd have to watch him in training. I'm not just going to make a decision in May about whether he should be in the England team in the World Cup.
But if the World Cup was next week, would he start?
Well, he'd be in my squad. He certainly wouldn't be out of my squad. And I'd be thinking of a way of how I get him into the team. And again, the opposition I'm playing against would play a part.
It's not about the opposition, Tony. It's about how good England are. Can they... Can they play to his strengths? We're going down the road. Do you build the team around Trent?
Do you need to play to Trent Alexander-Arnold's strengths?
I don't know if England are capable.
But do they need to? That's the point. Do they need to? Surely it should be about Raheem Sterling and Harry Kane's strengths. Because we've got Kyle Walker and we've got Reece James. That's the point. So do you need to rejig things to accommodate this incredible player?
Do you play a black four or do you play a three with two wing-backs?
Yeah.
Okay. Then you can make an argument. Then you could play Reece right of a three. Okay. And you could play Trent as more of a wing-back. You can make that argument as a logical one of making England incredibly dangerous, in my opinion.
We're going to have this conversation about England as we get to the Nations
I went off
League.
Track
No. It's all part of it, Tony. It's all part of it. It was interesting though because we're going back to talking about Diaz, not to talk about him as a player, but his the ease with which he has come into this country and into that team and excelled. You mentioned him whipping up the crowd, but it's all part of his mentality and his character as well, which I think is one of the things about the recruitment here that's also being missed. He fits the mode of player in terms of a character that Jurgen Klopp wants. Just him being so ferocious going forward, but his desire to get into the box, his desire to take people on and score goals and all of that drive that he seems to have means that I think this monster mentality label that's been put onto Liverpool, he will be a big part of for years to come. That's all I wanted to say about them, really. We'll talk about Liverpool possibly being the best team in the world if they win the Champions League, which is coming up very, very soon, of course. But is anyone worried as Liverpool fans ahead of that Champions League final? Well, we've had two cup finals involving Liverpool. I don't know if I mentioned this earlier, but they didn't score in either of them. And they were playing Chelsea, who... I mean, they're an okay side, but they're not as good as they should have been this season. And certainly things aren't going great for the club at the moment, which Thomas Tuchel alluded to at the end. So are you concerned about Real Madrid, where things are going a lot better, that Karim Benzema, for example, isn't going to leave the chances out there? There were chances for Chelsea in both cup finals that they left out there. Are you concerned in any way that if you give Real Madrid those chances, you're not going to win the Champions League final?
Well, I'd just like to explain to you that your description of Chelsea as the world club and world European champions, as if they were a very mediocre...
They've had a disappointing season.
Well, that I'm not disagreeing with. But describe them, Hugh, as, sort of a mid-table Premier League.
No, I'm not saying that.
Incredibly well at the Bernabeu.
Yeah, and still didn't go through. And this is my point, okay? All I'm saying is, I think, can we agree that Real Madrid have been a better side than Chelsea this season? That Liverpool are going to play a better side than Chelsea in the Champions League final? I think they are. Oh, do we all hate Real Madrid now?
No,
think they're terrible.
I would...
They knocked Paris Saint-Germain and come on,
Chelsea...
Manchester City and Chelsea out of the Champions League.
No, I think Real Madrid have probably had the most fortunate run of getting through. I can't believe they've got past PSG, Chelsea and Man City in the same manner. That's my answer, because I was at the PSG... I was at Chelsea against Real Madrid at Stamford Bridge. I mean... Mendy's made a horrendous error. He's gifted Real Madrid a goal. They've ended up getting themselves 2-0 up in the tie with an away goal, and they have thrown it away. They've made enough mistakes. But then that was what PSG did, and that's what Man City. And if you want to say being clinical and being punished, that's what Real Madrid were very good at.
Okay, all right. Well, listen, no worries about the Champions League final for you two. So our only hope now is Manchester City to stop this quadruple in the Premier League at the weekend. I'm sure we'll look ahead to that game on Thursday. We're going to talk Manchester City a little bit later on. Just finally, on the FA Cup final, we need to talk about Chelsea in a little bit more detail. Tony, as a former Chelsea striker, Henry Winter has written in the Times this weekend about the game being Romelu Lukaku's wasted chance. Thomas Tuchel had given him the trust. He started the game. Kai Havertz wasn't fit anyway. I think he might have started if he was. Was it a wasted chance from Lukaku? The only thing I could say watching him was I didn't think he was at full fitness. He certainly didn't look, the in terms of his physique and fitness, the player that he was in Italy. He hasn't started and played regularly this season as much as he would want to. Maybe he just has one of those physiological makeups that basically means if he's not playing regularly, he will maybe be a little bit slower, a little bit heavier. But I also think his style of play against Virgil van Dijk, I mean, he's just going to eat that up all day. I mean, go on, if you want to lean into me, put your back into me. If you want to hold the ball, you know, you need to offer something different against van Dijk, who is the best in the world, I think.
Yeah, he was poor on the day, quite static, judging him against Wolves and Leeds, which he'd obviously previously got goals against. Tough one. He just doesn't seem to fit for me into Chelsea's way of playing. You know, if you're static and you want to back into players all the time, one's 6'4" and the other one's probably 6'4", maybe even 6'5", two centre-halves. So him intimidating them is probably not going to work, especially as there's two of them, because he ended up playing on both of them at times.
Yeah.
You know, he'd end up falling on Konate and then sometimes Van Dijk. It was a really bad day for him. It's been a really poor season. Their top goal scorer in the Premier League is Mason Mount. Right, all forwards at Chelsea have had a really bad year this year. So I just, you know, said to you about where they were as a club, but they've really suffered in forward areas. They're third only because of how good they were defensively for large parts of the season, and probably midfield and maybe wide areas.
Yeah,
definitely in the centre forward positions. And Lukaku has come for a big fee. I don't know where Timo Werner stands at the football club. I'm probably thinking they're probably trying to offload him. I'm not sure Havertz can play the number nine and get enough goals over the course of a season. Very talented boy, but I don't see him in that position. And Lukaku, if you are, and I've said this before, I was a big centre forward. If I didn't play, I was never as sharp as I should be. And there's a lot of us. I would say John Artson, if you want to go back in the past, and you know, and Noel Quinn, and many, many others who have played that centre forward role, we tend to lose our fitness slightly quicker than most. Wide wingers or midfielders are not as big. We seem to pay the price for looking like we're carrying, say, a little bit more timber. And we need it. We need physical. If you look at heavyweight boxers, they gas quick. The reason they gas quick, because they're big guys. So if you're not fully on your training and playing week in, week out, you can look cumbersome, lethargic, not quite getting there. And that's exactly the description I'd give to Lukaku at the moment.
What did you make of his performance? Was it a wasted opportunity for Lukaku?
Well, I wouldn't frame it that way, Hugh, because I don't see how he could have changed it. He's become the epitome of almost in the past football. He doesn't seem to run at all. He ran. I remember
short distances.
He ran once to meet the ball, and it was like, oh, shouldn't that's not what we That's not how football is anymore.
Yeah.
Doesn't it hold the record for 5 kilometres in the game? Isn't it one of the shortest distances ever?
I mean, there were times where it was really he would actually physically get involved in the game, and he'd run down the channels on one side and he'd hold the ball up and he'd play it back to a Chelsea defender or a midfielder who'd go back, and they'd do what they do with the back three, and it would come down to Rudiger on the left hand side, and then he'd look for a forward pass and Lukaku would still be standing in the left back area on the other side of the pitch. Like he could do it for 60 seconds, and then for the next 2 minutes after that he looked really, really tired actually. And maybe, look, it's a hot day and he hasn't been playing regularly, but you would expect more from a player of his quality. And also, of course, £97.5 million,
but you can't
get away from.
You're framing it as a wasted opportunity, as if he could have turned up at Wembley and reinvented himself.
No, but I do think your physical condition is something that when you're away from starting regularly, players should work on.
It was his first game in a week as well.
I don't think players, I mean, look, the modern sports science and technology, if you're going to put in the extra hard yards and you're going to take care of your diet and you're going to take care of the way that you live outside of football, that players now should change that much physically. Because, you know, there are other players that come onto the pitch at Chelsea. Yeah, there might be different shapes, like Tony mentioned, but they haven't been playing regularly either. And they don't seem to be, you know, Ross Barkley came on at the end and, all right, he didn't play for a long period of time, and so did Ruben Loftus-Cheek. But you weren't watching them like, what have they been doing? You know, Ross Barkley doesn't look like he's got really unfit from literally barely playing a single game this year. I think he's played 5 or 6 games all season, basically.
I'm trying to think a way of defending him, as in, look, he's had injury issues and he's had COVID and he's been out the team.
Yeah.
That combination is not a very good one to be at your very peak of your condition. So I'm giving him the benefit of that.
Should he stay at Chelsea for next year?
Only if Tuchel wants him. I'm not sure Tuchel does. I think he hasn't played well enough and regularly enough for a manager to go, yeah, we need him, but it's, you know, he's got a guy on a huge contract, so it's a difficult one.
And we have no evidence that he's banging on the manager's door saying, I love this club, I want to play every week. The only public interviews he's given have been to say he can't wait to go back to Italy.
Listen, one player who is definitely leaving Chelsea this summer, we quickly got a touch on Andreas Christensen. Confirmed by Thomas Tuchel that he's on his way to Barcelona. But the story in the Times this weekend is that Christensen made himself unavailable for selection on the morning of the FA Cup final, which came to the surprise of the Chelsea players that he had left the team hotel, and to Thomas Tuchel as well. Tony, is this something that you think is reminiscent of when you played? Big games come up, players, maybe, I think Christensen not starting. Maybe he was told he wasn't starting and that affected the situation. Obviously, we know mental health is an issue now in football too. We don't know what went on with Andreas Christensen or why he felt he needed to leave. But, you know, have you ever seen a player walk out before a huge game like this?
Not in that. No, if you're putting the game as an FA Cup final, absolutely not. And even if he was, if he was named in the squad but wasn't going to be starting, well, why would you say I'm not available for the game? I don't get that, because you're on the bench and you might play, you might not. You don't need to do all this. Now, Rudiger's played and he's leaving the football club. Okay? He's put himself, his arm up to play. Now,
He was starting.
Yeah, well, okay. But if you're starting or you're not starting, it doesn't make much of a difference. You're either with the team, you're still in the contract for a football club.
Yeah.
And if your manager wants you and needs you, you should make yourself available.
Rudiger, though, has a good excellent relationship with the Chelsea fans and the media. Yeah. Everybody thinks he's fantastic. What a loss to Chelsea. Arguably Chelsea's player of the season. And certainly the personality of the team, one of the big personalities of the team. Christensen has a very poor relationship with the fans.
Yeah.
And all the way through, he came from the Chelsea Academy. He was sent out on loan as a youngster. He was sent out on loan as a adult, if you like, to Germany. And the word was, you know, a very elegant defender, needs toughening up. Comes back, and it's a really demanding shop window, isn't it? And because that was the background, every time he made a mistake or didn't seem to dominate or have the aura of a proper centre half, didn't seem to be able to control a game, he had labels on him like, oh, he's a bit flaky. Mm. He's not got a strong character, has he? And then this snowballs, and you get to the point where he has a pretty dreadful game in the home leg against Real Madrid. is sort of blamed for the defeat. And only because Mendy made that mistake was the spotlight off him, actually. If Mendy hadn't, everyone would have been saying, oh, Christensen, you know, he's not got what it takes. And he's not, I just don't think he has the personality to want to go back out and prove people wrong. And I think whether he's like ill, genuinely ill, but whether that's because he's actually sort of afraid of what's next and that makes him ill. So he is ill, he is genuinely ill, but it's sparked by not fitting in properly. That might be what's happening.
My last game in England was the 1994 FA Cup final. I played in the semi-final and played in the previous Premier League games before the final. Got left out in the final and my contract was up in that summer and I was going to a World Cup. And the thought of me thinking, well, if he names me as sub, I'm not going to tell him I'm not going to play. No chance. I want to be there. And do you know what? I wasn't a favourite of the fans. You know, Alison's just talking about, you know, Christensen, and he's not. I wasn't a fan's favourite. You know, I would have been one that they wouldn't be bothered if I stayed or not. But I'm still want to put myself up because it always come down to I'm under contract for this football club. So my duty is to be available for my colleagues who I've shared a dressing room for the last 3 years with. I want to be part. I want to be there for them. I want to be in the trenches with them. If needed, I'm called upon. I'm going to play. So there isn't really an answer that Christians could give me that would settle, you know, sit right with me. Because whether your contract's up, whether you don't like it because you're not being named in the sub, if you've got other issues, then I'm sure Tuchel would have known about it and not selected him. He's asked him and he's obviously told him an answer that Tuchel didn't like. So why I brought my situation in is because I was there in an FA Cup final that got left out and got put on the bench. Delighted to be there. Delighted to be on that bench that day.
Not a great day for Chelsea, I think, in more ways than one. Well, not a great day for their men's team this weekend, but it was a fantastic day for Chelsea's women. They beat Manchester City 3-2 after extra time at Wembley in front of over 49,000 fans. That's a new record for the fixture. Chelsea win the double. They retain the FA Cup from last year. Molly Hudson from The Times joins us now. It was fantastic from Emma Hayes' side once again. It was a tough match, I think, Molly, but they're relentless with these trophies. How do they do it?
I think you're completely right with that word. They are just so relentless. And I think there's part of it, or quite a big part of it, has to be mentality because, you know, you laugh there about the goals. Like the opening of that game was very, very cagey. Sort of the first half an hour, we were thinking, God, it looks like we'll never get a goal. And then it really opened up. But I think you could argue that Manchester City were the better team for large spells of that game. And I think that is sort of the biggest credit of Chelsea, that however they play, they don't always have to play their best. You know, we've talked about it on this podcast before. It's not a new thing. They've done it throughout the season, that they just find a way and they are relentless. And when it comes down to those key moments, there's always a player providing that moment of magic. I mean, yesterday it was Erin Cuthbert with a brilliant finish. Obviously, Sam Kerr was there again with two goals, although, you know, not as spectacular as the brace she got last weekend. But they are just so relentless. And I think that comes from Emma and her mentality in the way that, even though it really looked as though the momentum has turned, we see it so many times when you get a late goal in normal time, the 89th minute goal from Hayley Rasso, which was a fantastic finish. You really thought that Manchester City would go on and take that advantage and go on and win the game. But then you realised they were playing Emma Hayes' Chelsea. And then you didn't think that because they just don't panic. They're just so calm, whatever happens. And I think that's what's so impressive about them, and that's why they have won so many trophies.
If they're going to continue winning trophies, I mean, it's a little bit like the conversation around the men's team, isn't it? What happens next with a new ownership group at the club? How important do you think it is, not just for Chelsea's women's team, but also for women's football in the UK, that Chelsea's new owners take it as seriously as their previous ones?
I think it's super important. I think I wrote a story on Friday that Thomas Tuchel and Emma Hayes had separate dinners with Todd Boehly. And I feel like for me, that was really important that he'd actually taken the time to see Emma. They'd actually had lunch. They'd spent 2 hours with the squad, watching them train. He'd taken a real interest in terms of the Champions League and the kind of playing field there, I suppose, because it's sort of very different, as we've talked about on here before, competing in the Women's Super League to the Champions League. And those teams that are doing really well in the Champions League do actually have bigger budgets than Chelsea, which seems a little bit crazy to say when, you know, we're all more than aware that Chelsea, Man City, Arsenal have a lot bigger budgets than a lot of teams in the Women's Super League. In Champions League, it's the other way around. And I think it was a really positive sign that he really took an interest in the women's team. I think we're at a stage now where, when there was ownership troubles in the past, you saw women's football as the thing that kind of just got left behind. You know, it was the thing that was cost cut, or it was the thing that they didn't really care about. It's actually the opposite now. I think if you look at what Newcastle have done under their new owners, the team are, I think, are going to go professional, and they're not even in the top two tiers of women's football. So I think for a team like Chelsea, it's, you just have to invest. Like, he just can't be seen to come into the club and not invest in that club. It's too much of a attractive prospect. Women's football is too much of a growth sector for him not to do that, particularly the comparative cost that it takes to actually compete. Although we are talking about, you know, millions of pounds comparatively to the men's game, you know, what Tuchel would have to do in order to bridge that gap to Manchester City and Liverpool. You know, Chelsea, to even bridge that gap to a Lyon or a team like that, it's not as much investment. And I think it's really positive, but I think, you know, that's the minimum. He should take an interest in Chelsea women, because they're a fantastic club. They've done things the right way. And I think it's the minimum that we should expect now.
Absolutely. I agree with you. Emma Hayes, though, the Chelsea boss, saying afterwards that she felt Manchester City underestimated her team. Do you think that was a fair comment, or is it mind games ahead of next season?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of mind games from Emma. You know, she's, of all the managers in the Women's Super League, she's very, very aware of what she's saying. I think Manchester City played really well. I think Gareth Taylor and the City team would be more than aware of how good Chelsea are. I don't think you can really underestimate a team like Chelsea when you've just seen them win a third consecutive Women's Super League title the weekend before. So, yeah, I don't think they underestimated them. I think she will have been very aware that that game could have gone either way yesterday. And I think she was just so happy that kind of Chelsea had come out on top. And yeah, I think I did feel sorry for Manchester City. I felt particularly sorry for Alex Greenwood, who scored, well, I think it was still on target, wasn't it? But deflected it past their own goalkeeper. It was difficult. And I think they've done really well to be that close to Chelsea when you think they lost 4-0 to them in the league in November, I think it was. The way that they've come back has been really impressive.
So can Manchester City now be real credible title challengers in the WSL next season?
I think they can. I think, unfortunately for Manchester City, they've got a little bit of the same problem they had this year, which is that they kind of all went to Team GB in Tokyo. They come back late. Everyone got injured. They didn't really have a pre-season. This season, next season, we're going to be in the same sort of problem. The fact that everyone is going to have been part of the Euros, pretty much the entire England team also played for Manchester City. I know it'll be a similar thing for a lot of the clubs, I suppose, but I think that's where they've really struggled this season, that lack of pre-season, that lack of preparation. And Gareth Taylor was talking yesterday that ideally there wouldn't be a huge turnover in players, just because you don't really have that time to bed them in with the way that the calendar is at the moment. And, you know, it's not just this season coming, it's the one after. We'll have the World Cup next summer. So I think they'll be up there. It's just if they can avoid this same sort of, just the amount of injuries they had this season was incredible really early on. And I think if they can avoid that, then they'll definitely be up there, because when everyone's fit, you saw yesterday the quality they have, that front three in particular, you know, Lauren Hemp, Bunny Shaw and Chloe Kelly is a front three that would cause any defence in the world some problems.
Molly Hudson, thank you for joining us on the Game podcast. Really appreciate it. Still to come, we're going to be talking about events in the Premier League as West Ham draw with Manchester City and all the events in the relegation battle too. Make sure, though, if you're enjoying the podcast, that you like us, rate us a review, and make sure you're subscribed.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's get to events at the London Stadium next on the Game Podcast. It was a wonderful day for Mark Noble after 18 years at West Ham United. He was given a rousing send-off, tears in his eyes, but he did, of course, still have time to sweep the dressing room afterwards in true Mark Noble style, a legend of the club. There aren't many of those these days, but yeah, it was nice to see him get a fitting send-off. The match itself was a very good one for West Ham. They went 2-0 up. Jared Bowen once again showing that he, I think, has a future as an England starter. But the comeback from Manchester City, the quality there, okay, fortunate with the own goal and the way that Jack Grealish's goal went in, to be perfectly fair, but they fought back into the game and got a crucial point in terms of the title race, because it means goal difference will now not be an element as we get to the final day of the season. Alison, you were there. What are your reflections on how both teams played?
We're at the end of the season now, and there's one game that really matters for me, and that is how Stephen Gerrard sets up Villa when they go to the Etihad on the final day of the season. So he's going to have to analyse this match and learn from it. And I think he can, actually. I think West Ham are a better team than Aston Villa, and they were at home, so it's a big ask. But they don't have Kyle Walker, City. I don't have Ruben Diaz. Don't have John Stones to step in either. I think probably Kyle Walker was the big miss, simply because of his pace. I mean, as soon as there was a through ball, there weren't many of them, but as soon as it was a clever through ball, there was no one there to react. They looked porous and like a bang average team at the back, actually. Because I made the analogy in my piece that City, you treat their own half of the pitch like it was once a very beautiful vegetable patch in their garden, but they've been distracted by nice weather and the kids want to have a paddling pool out and they've forgotten about it. They play so much football in the opposition half. When they don't have Kyle Walker to just mop everything up, they can be got at. And I think what West Ham did was you sort of go in. There's a way of facing City is that you start the game either defeatist and just think, oh, we don't want to get hammered. And you sort of, as a group, accept you're probably going to lose. Or you do what West Ham did, which was you defend with intense concentration, but enough self-belief to know that you can, on the counter, do something. And if you hold your nerve and have the personality to do it and the intelligence to do it, just bide your time and you'll get that opportunity. And that is how it panned out. So I feel that with those three defenders missing, there is a way through City, who, like I say, there were times when it's like they forgot that they have half the pit they're supposed to defend in. It was poor defending. Mm. So there's a chance that the last day will be dramatic, if nothing else.
Well, I think you're right about the defence of Manchester City. I have been for many weeks, I'm sure you've been listening, concerned about the idea of Fernandinho at centre-back. He's the one player back there that I really think has a great character, but physically, I mean, Ollie Watkins and Danny Ings will be licking their lips on the final day of the season trying to run in behind Fernandinho, as Mikel Antonio really had an enjoyable game this weekend as well. But you've got Alexander Zinchenko at left-back, who I think is lovely on the ball, but isn't exactly Vinny Jones. You've got Aymeric Laporte, who isn't exactly Van Dijk, you know, a good player as well, but I think has character traits for the big games and the tough moments that I wouldn't want in my centre-back. And then you've got Joao Cancelo, who, again, you can get at him. You know, he's a very good player, probably going to be in the team of the year, but you can get at Joao Cancelo in a defensive mindset, I think. Going forward, he's absolutely brilliant. So I do think there can be joy for Aston Villa on the final day. Defensively, though, I wonder whether they can cope with Manchester City, and when Manchester City get the ball in wide areas, whether the way that Aston Villa have been playing recently, they can, unless you think they'll change the system to maybe, I don't know, play wing backs and an extra defender back there, and maybe they can see out the game and Stephen Gerrard can whip off his suit at the end and have his maybe Alisson, did you wear your Gerrard shirt at the weekend, by the way? Because I didn't even ask you that at the start, but he might pull off his suit and have a Stephen Gerrard 8 Liverpool shirt underneath and run around the Etihad Stadium swinging it over his head, I don't know, something like that. It could happen, you know, it might happen. I don't know. Tony, do you think Villa need to change up then for this weekend?
No, I think they'll go with a 4. Look, you mentioned Fernandinho, and he's played centre half and right back in recent weeks. Right back, you know, you could easily get past him with real pace. Look, what is he now, Fernandinho? 36, 37? You know, we're asking, it's a big ask for someone of that age. And yes, his ability, but he's not his natural position. Now, can Villa cause them problems? Yes. But it has to come from a very brave approach. And I thought, I was like Alisson. I'm glad Alisson mentioned there, how do you go about beating City? Do you want to really be pragmatic and really just offer very little and just defend for your lives? Which I don't think is a very good idea, because there's always a moment in a game where they can take advantage and get a wonder goal, get a penalty or anything. All these type of things can happen against City. I think you have to show bravery. And the one thing that stood out for me in the game was the first time ball. If they can get in that habit bit of when City are just about to try and catch you on the offside trap, that you get your forward in just on that moment. You're literally, it's such a fine line. You're going to get caught offside a lot. But Ollie Watkins is very good at that, of doing that role, of going, I'm going to play right on the shoulder of the defender. Once it gets played, I might be offside, but I could just be a tad onside. And then you can expose City and exploit what they do, because they are not the same back line without Diaz, Walker, and maybe even Stones.
I wanted to talk about the penalty as well. I think we'll see exactly what Villa do at the weekend, and we'll either be you'll both be celebrating next Monday or not, I think. But I think Riyad Mahrez, when he stood up to take that penalty, I was concerned, immediately concerned. And I was like, no, not Mahrez. Not in these moments. He's a great penalty taker. He's got great style on the ball and quality, but... nah, I needed Kevin De Bruyne to take that penalty. We all did. Everyone that doesn't support Liverpool was begging, you know, because we're never going to hear the end of it if you win the quadruple. So obviously we were like, Kevin De Bruyne, please, Kevin De Bruyne. All the neutrals. I know all the neutrals, you're with me when I say this. You know, there'll be no end of office chat and building site chat and here in the studio from these Liverpool fans if they win a quadruple. It will never end and it will be an unbearable summer. So we need Manchester City to win the Premier League title. It is official. I thought Kevin De Bruyne, the character of the player, the leadership there, you know, the strength of character he needed to take that penalty. I couldn't believe Riyad Mahrez
was taking it. But you're ascribing those qualities to him, but he obviously doesn't have them, or he would have done.
No, he might just not be as good a penalty taker.
He doesn't want to.
Well, Mahrez hasn't got the greatest record, has he?
He hasn't got the worst record either, though. And look, I don't know. I didn't see someone that was going to... You know, one of those where I was...
But do you say that? Okay, Hugh, because a lot of people are guilty.
No, I don't.
A lot of people who say, don't fancy him, but they'll say it on every penalty taker. You know, it's... I personally, where I'd go along with you, I don't get the idea of how you can take all the free kicks outside the 18-yard box and your main striker or the guy that's going to take them then doesn't take the penalty. And I'm sure there's people listening and say, well, there is examples of people who take free kicks but don't take penalties. But to me, it is an obvious choice because he is one of the world's best midfielders and he has the composure in his game to just be in that moment. This is not like a normal league game. This is not your 4-1 up. This is 2-2. Basically, if you score, you've won the Premier League. That is the ultimate difference of why I would want De Bruyne on that penalty.
It's funny because you may say that I'm one of those people that says that to every penalty taker, but even at the weekend, genuinely, the only Chelsea penalty taker that I was concerned about was Azpilicueta. And because of his quality on the ball and his goal scoring potential. I know he scored a brilliant goal recently, made it look like he was a pomp Raul, but you know, usually he hasn't got the greatest strike in the world. And I did think he's got the character. So when he stood up, I had no concerns over his character. You know, I was like, Azpilicueta, very good choice, solid choice. But what I genuinely screamed at the screen, slam it in the bottom corner as hard as you can. That's all I was thinking. I was like, run up to it and smash it in. I didn't want him to try and do anything special. Maybe by his standards, he didn't try and do anything special. But I don't know if the moment got to him or not.
No, but to be fair, to Mahrez, I've just been sent this stat. Okay, he's only missed two penalties for Man City. So the first was against Liverpool in 2018 and then again against West Ham. And he scored 7 in between. Nine consecutive penalties in between. So he's not... Prior to that, he was always in the list of the worst penalty takers in the Premier League history. Okay. So he's got...
He wasn't great at Leicester.
There are two sides to Riyad Mahrez.
But it's key. One of those penalty misses was against Liverpool. in a massive game, I'm sure.
Yeah, it was against Liverpool.
Yeah, exactly. In a massive title decider, possible title deciding game.
Well,
the other one is the same, exactly the same type of moment. He's missed again. Maybe we're splitting. Maybe I'm splitting here.
Great importance.
Do I think?
No, did he miss one in the African Nations?
He did.
Great point.
I think it was important.
I'm talking about the moment because it's like, we're going round in the mill week in, week out, penalty taken, your records. Okay, this is different. You know, I've just explained that taking one where you win the Premier League, basically, in scoring is way different from taking one when you're 3-0 up and you just get another goal.
Absolutely, but the best person to take the high-pressure penalty is one who takes penalties a lot.
Yeah.
Because you only get good at something by practising it. And yes, there are differences between taking a penalty that effectively wins you the title and taking a penalty which is mid-table nonsense. But it's still an important... Every penalty will be in front of 60,000 or so, and
or the whole world
matter.
Up in there.
Yeah. Okay, then, Tony.
Sorry,
tell us. Well, you take penalties throughout your career, yes?
No, I took penalties towards the end of my career. Well, from the moment I joined Marseille and then beyond. I had taken them now and again at Millwall, but not. I wasn't the main penalty taker. But I actually became... I had a very good ratio. My last 2 years, I didn't miss a pen. And my last year, I took six and scored six. OK? And then I took one in a World Cup last 16 and scored in a World Cup moment. And if I'm comparing that penalty to, even though I scored, to any other penalty, it's not even close. That walk from the centre circle to the penalty spot, knowing the whole world's watching, family and friends in the stand, it was...
Is that going through your head?
Oh, absolutely. I'm trying to keep focus. And I can remember thinking, low and hard. Just talking to myself, I was going there. Weren't thinking of any... I was trying to, you know, get myself in that mindset of just low and hard and not think about looking at the keeper, not thinking about the crowd, not looking at my teammates. And what I did, I just got myself thinking low and hard was all I have to do. And that's what I did, and I scored. And by the way, I took a divot, and my colleagues take the mickey out of me now, who play with me, and saying, the divot, it's like a golf shot when you took that penalty, which is, you know, sort of funny, but it's I can't compare the two penalties of one in that type of scenario. So I can imagine for the Mahrez this weekend is not like taking a penalty in a routine Premier League match. There is a million miles difference from me.
Did the goal shrink? Because you were a forward. You'd scored plenty of goals.
Well,
when you looked at the goal...
I tried not to look at the keeper.
Oh, really?
Because likewise, the keeper you think gets bigger, the goal gets smaller, and then you try... One of the things you got to not do is start changing your mind and thinking... Well, I'm going to put it in the bottom left now. And then I know players who have said this to me. They've thought about putting it in the bottom left-hand corner and the last moment gone the other way. And you sort of think, why did you do that? So I kept thinking low and hard, and that was all I was... It was so simple for me. It was so ABC robotic of just going, look, I could have still missed it. But that was my mindset.
Pep is supposed to be this perfectionist, hugely demanding manager who sees weakness where all of us see brilliance in his players, always wants more. And yet his tenure at City, their penalty taking has been... relatively poor.
Yeah,
He doesn't seem to have got any to grips with it. And there's a really nice... It's only small, but it's a really nice piece in the Times today where there's this Norwegian penalty expert who gave a sort of running commentary.
Erling Haaland.
He's called Geir Jourdet. Or Jourdet, I don't know. But anyway, he gave a running commentary on everything that Klopp did perfectly to prepare his players for the shootout and everything that Tuchel did wrong.
I thought it was nonsense. I saw this thread as well. My mates, we had an argument about it. I did think it was nonsense. I mentioned Azpilicueta missing. If he scores, then what do we take from the pictures then? Because Chelsea would have won the shootout. So I didn't get
But my point is you take penalties and the preparation for penalties very seriously.
Yes,
and accept that they can... kill you at key moments.
Yeah.
Or you do the whole old-fashioned manager thing, which is, you can't replicate it on the day, so we don't bother.
See, I can I just add one word on that? If we go back a year ago, England played the Euro final, and there was... And my only problem with the penalties and why England missed them, because I didn't have a problem with players missing per se, because people do miss penalties, but it was the fact that they were three teenagers. And that to me was, well, this is not an England routine game. It's a bit like I explained earlier. This is guys thrown into a scenario that they've never been. And that's, I thought, was really weird. That's decision making that I didn't get from upstairs, from Gareth, from his team and his staff, because of course they're capable of scoring. They're, you know, from Sancho to Rashford to Saka, they're brilliant players. They're well capable of scoring. But the fact that they were so young and never even got close to this experience bothered me.
No, I see what you mean. Listen, given our discussion, I think it comes down to a bit of a lottery. I'm going to say that I take no...
It's part of it, yes.
I take no conclusion from this, despite my anger over who took the penalty for Manchester City and my clear disappointment that Azpilicueta missed for Chelsea. I've decided after this conversation that it is a bit of a lottery. I take your point on the preparation, but you've got to imagine they've prepped.
It's marginal gains, for goodness sake. If you decide... We're going to take a scientific approach. We're going to squeeze all information that is available on how you prepare for a penalty shootout or an individual penalty. That has to be the right approach.
Yeah.
Thomas Tuchel clearly fiddling with a piece of paper and muttering to himself, leaves everyone in limbo. That can't be good.
Thomas Tuchel changed the goalkeeper in the last one in the League Cup final.
Yeah.
Whether you agree with that or not, but marginal games are very important. And just one quick word on this, because this is really important. If you take the number as one in four penalties a miss, let's go there, right, as a simplistic argument. So if you have any penalty taker that takes them regularly, if he has a less than 75% scoring ratio, he shouldn't be taking the penalties, because he's going to miss over a course of time more often than others that have a better ratio. Do you understand what I mean?
If it boils down to, oh, he wants to, so the manager will go to the player who wants to do it, is prepared to accept the pressure. Mm. How can you put that ahead of the statistics? That's terrible.
The only thing that I'd say is that I think that in the shootout in particular, both shootouts, I think changing the goalkeeper gives you a sense of like a lack of control over the situation. Like, we're a little bit frenetic here. We're chasing the situation. Let's change the goalkeeper. Let's see what happens. We're already like, you know, we're already throwing in this element, which I know is marginal gains. But for me, it's like, well, he's not the best keeper. I mean, people can say, oh, that he's a better penalty saver and they've got a better record and whatnot. But if you're on the pitch, surely you're like, well, he's not as good a goalkeeper. Like that's all I'd be thinking. I'd be like, I wouldn't feel less confident of scoring a penalty against the keeper that has come on just for this scenario to save five shots. So
see, that's as an example of everything. That's one of my least favourite words in the world, in my head, not in the world, in my head, is an example, because you can give an example of everything. Because Tim Krul, with him with the Netherlands, he was a substitute goalkeeper. Louis van Gaal picked him to face the penalty shootout and wins.
Yeah.
So.
Hindsight is everything in this situation. Yeah. Okay. So, guys, I apologise. I was wrong about everything from the start. Right, that's the top of the table done with. Let's very quickly talk about the bottom. Leeds got a vital point. Pascal Struijk with a header right of the game of their game against Brighton. They were back to their attacking best, and it could be a huge point in terms of them staying in the Premier League, because they move outside of the relegation zone. That is a place now occupied by Burnley, who had an awful handball, in my opinion, decide their game against Spurs. The Everton game was really decided by a missed penalty decision for a grapple, a grab of the shirt, if you like, and a straight red for Branthwaite. It ended up as a 3-2 win for Brentford in the end. It's going to be really interesting this final week of the season to see who goes down. I think the points are key. I mean, we might as well start with Burnley, really, because if they lose these two games, which is possible, of course, the final two games of the season, they will be going down. I don't know. Let's talk about this handball, Tony. Handball, Ashley Barnes, it came off the shin of Davinson Sanchez. Should it have been given? Letter of the law?
I get frustrated with Hugh, because 12 yards from a spot kick against a goalkeeper is a huge advantage. And when I saw the penalty given, I immediately thought, yeah, it's within the rules. That's the new laws of the game. That's a pen. Do I hate it? Yes, absolutely. I was a big advocate of VAR, and I never knew the consequences of decisions that are so trivial that, like you, I couldn't believe it was given. Only case I can make is the laws have made it this way. Because if you look at every corner, every free kick that goes into penalty area, everyone's waving their arms around in some way. You know, it's whether it's deliberate is the most important thing to me. If there is a deliberate attempt to get a hand or a ball that stops the opponent having an advantage, I get it. But there was no way on earth I could see Ashley Barnes gaining advantage. He was totally unaware of where the ball bounced. And there's about four players with their arms up in the air. Okay, the ball's not there, but they're all waving their arms around.
Barely touches his arm.
Barely.
It took eight viewings to realise it actually had touched
exactly.
his arm.
I thought it was incredibly harsh, and I'm like you, I'm with you. I just think it's a very sad place to go, because my fear is where you end up. You know, if you keep taking away layer by layer, you know, how insignificant an incident is, you'll end up with, it's like Alison just touched on, you didn't even really notice that it hit his arm.
Yeah. I think it's one of those that's way too highly scrutinised. The other thing is, I think if you go over to the screen, watch it in real time, like show it in the situation in real time, at super slow motion. I mean, it literally crawls up the shirt of Ashley Barnes and glides past his hand. It's like, you've slowed that down so much that it almost looked like he had time to react, when of course in real time he had absolutely no time to react. The only argument is, it's in the law books, and really that's what you need to complain about, because the law says if your arm is up above your shoulder height and the ball hits it, it's handball. And his arm was up there and the ball did touch it. And so really we should be complaining about the law rather than how the situation was judged by either VAR
law doesn't say it's handball if upon watching in extreme slow motion from 26 different angles there is the possibility that it touched the arm. I mean, it's just like Tony said, there's no advantage gained whatsoever.
No, and just on that, I've actually had this argument for a while, and I remember talking about this in a radio show. I can't get why we have to watch things in slow motion. I don't get that. You should watch it exactly how the game happens in the same time. For me, you know, watching it happen and then making your assessment.
Yeah.
Because if you dissect anything, you can make, certainly in context, you can bring something to the table. It's like contact with someone touching someone's leg. You're slowing it down, you can see there's minimal contact, and then that's a pen.
Yeah. I it was a sad way to see the game decided, because Burnley are obviously fighting for every single point. A big win, by the way, for Tottenham in terms of that top four. We'll be talking about that towards the end of the week. I'm sure it'll still be all to play for as long as Arsenal can get something at Newcastle. That's by the by. In terms of the relegation battle, Everton and Goodison Park, more decisions, more VAR deciding the game there. What do you think? Because I think Richarlison probably was fouled. Frank Lampard saying, you know, you would give that tug anywhere else on the pitch, you'd be giving a free kick for the way that his shirt was held, I think, by Janssen. Straight down the other end, Tony is fouled by Branthwaite. It's a straight red card, and it changed the game completely.
There is clear shirt pulling. It is clearly shirt pulling. But if you're pulling someone's shirt and they're not moving, and you're just grappling to make sure you know where they are, make them aware that you're in charge of the penalty area.
He could have been moving had he not been held, though.
Yeah,
his shirt was almost pulled off his back.
I don't know. I wouldn't say it's as clear cut as all that, because I just felt, I just, given the way Richarlison plays, he'd have fallen over if he felt he was impeded, and he didn't. I'm not saying he ought to have fallen over. I'm just saying he would have.
You know, you're looking at guys that train every day, spend quite a bit of time in the gym, get slightly caught and they go down quite easily. Sometimes I laugh at someone. Richarlison's won the worst by a country mile. I saw a linesman at West Ham versus Man City get caught by a Laporte where his foot goes on him and catches his. He basically.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
And then carried on doing the flag. And it was the worst challenge I'd seen.
In the game.
In the game, right? And I kept thinking, I've watched 10 players go to ground, you know, like in the Everton game, more often than not, with very little contact. And I'm watching a linesman who's basically just gone, oh, a bit sore, tapped to Laporte and sorry, move on, carry on. No sponge man, no yellow card. A bit frustrating for me.
And I've got to give a special mention for Joe Gildhart of Leeds, who, with a brilliant bit of skill, I mean, it's unbelievable, really, to have the confidence to do it. Just chipping the ball over Lewis Dunk in the six-yard box, flowing it to the back post. Pascal Strike heads it in. That point takes Leeds out of the relegation zone. They do have just one game to play. Both Burnley and Everton, two matches left. Do you think Leeds are going to stay up, Tony? What do you think about them at the moment? They had 19 shots in the game. They were getting bodies forward in the second half, piling forward in the way that they used to under Bielsa. And I thought, oh my word, if they play it that way at the weekend, they'll get a couple of goals at least. By the way, Leeds go away to Brentford in their final game. Burnley away at Villa and then Newcastle at home on the final day. And Everton Thursday night, I'll be there. Palace at home and then Arsenal away on the final day of the season. So yeah, as I was saying, if Leeds continue to play like that, can they stay up? One game? Continue for one game to play like that?
Scoring a goal in the last minute, and yes, you've read all the numbers, and like, I didn't see the game. I've seen enough of Leeds in recent weeks. What I would say, don't expect Brentford not to turn up, because they will, as we saw at Goodison. And there is a bit of rivalry between them two in the Championship when they, you know, both fought for promotion. So I'm not sure Thomas Frank is going to be thinking that Leeds are going to come here. He's going to send out his best 11 and they're going to try and beat him.
Thomas Frank, who might be about to be named manager of the season, it's their home goodbye after a phenomenal campaign. It'll just feel like a cup final. It'll feel amazing. That is so tough for Leeds, that game.
It's a tough one. And Leeds' best chance of staying up is going to be Burnley losing both games, in my opinion, because I don't believe they can. They'll go to Brentford and go and win that game. I think it's going to be beyond them. I think it's a tough one.
Okay, we'll see how they get on in the final week of the season. We'll probably, I'm just going to say this now, executive decision, we might wait until those games on Thursday before we see you again to look ahead to the final weekend of the Premier League season.
But I want to know, I know we've run out of time, but I just need to know from Tony, Frank Lampard has as many wins for Everton as his team have got red cards. Has he got the balance wrong in terms of them going out with fighting spirit?
It's been a difficult one because they've been a mess, and even the games they won early on in his tenure at Everton were Boreham Wood in the Cup, Brentford in the FA Cup, where they made quite a few changes. There's been some, you know, you could take some hope out of the Man United performance that they had. I think it's been a really mixed bag for him, and you can argue that has he been caught up as a manager? You know, has he become like a supporter? Because the you know, if you saw all the atmosphere before the game and it was galvanised, when you say, well, Klopp does that, you know, Klopp does that, but he's got a much better team. You know, doing that when you have a confidence in your team is slightly different. I saw some hope for them against Liverpool because I thought their work rate and they had a lot of athleticism in their team. I don't know if it's going to fall flat on their face. They'll survive, but I think for next season, I don't think Everton's season is going to be any different from what we've seen.
Red, that many red cards, though.
Yeah.
It's
a lot. And ill discipline is part of bad results. It's a combination.
Right, that is it for what is probably now a very bumper edition of the Game podcast. Remember, if you enjoy it, make sure you're subscribed. You can get more great journalism from The Times and The Sunday Times at thetimes.co.uk/thegame. Final week of the season. We are in to the home stretch, people, but I wonder which way it'll go. We will react to everything, all the midweek football, including that Europa League final on Friday. So we'll see you then.